Welcome to the Benefits Executive Roundtable, hosted by Dorothy Koshu, President of Advanced Benefit Consulting. Dorothy is a nationally recognized benefits and compliance consultant and group health broker. Here, you'll listen to industry experts break down the latest news and trends in employee benefits, healthcare reform, regulations and compliance, all designed to empower executive decisions.
Welcome to the Benefits Executive Roundtable. I'm your host, Dorothy Koshu, President of Advanced Benefit Consulting, and I'm happy to introduce this week's guest, John Green, Senior Vice President of Government Affairs for the National Association of Benefits and Insurance Professionals, or NABIP. Welcome, John, and thanks for being here today.
Well, thank you for having me. This is my first time, and I hope it's not the last.
I'm sure it won't be, as long as you don't mind me keep calling you and bugging you and asking you to be on my podcast. Well, I asked John to be my guest this week following the NABIP's annual Capital Conference in Washington, D.C. I know it's a ton of work for you and the staff and the Board of Trustees getting ready for that, and as a past board member myself, I truly understand that. And as a member myself, I want to thank you. And I know that other members that are listening, thank you as well, because we do have a lot of subscribers that are members. Tell us about the conference. Can you tell our listeners what the purpose of the conference is this year and how NABIP gets members involved?
Sure, I'd be glad to. So associations often conduct a fly-in to Washington, and it demonstrates to their clients and to members of Congress their commitment to their issue. And in our case, that would be healthcare. You are where the rubber meets the road. You're working with directly with clients, whether they be group clients, Medicare clients. It just, you know, runs the whole gamut, right? And what's unique about your role as an agent is that you know how markets work. And since our association represents all market segments, that's what makes NABIP special. It's your opportunity to speak to members of Congress directly about the issues that are affecting your clients, and specifically around legislation that is before them, and telling them why or why not they should support or oppose a particular piece of legislation. And this year, we did get a lot of things passed in the House. And so the action really is in the Senate to try to get them through the Senate and to the president.
Well, thank you for that. And that's a great intro into what I want to talk to you about today, because obviously the political scene in Washington is pretty crazy right now, as it always is, particularly in an election year. But what makes this year as an election year different from others in recent history?
So margins are very close in this Congress. The Senate map actually favors Republicans, and Democrats currently have a one-seat advantage. And Republicans feel that this is their chance to try to flip control of the Senate. Because if you look at the map beyond this year's election, the map gets really bad for Republicans. And so it's sort of do or die this time, or they sit in the wilderness likely for the next couple of cycles. And so if that were to happen, I would anticipate more retirements. But as a Republican myself, I think there's a lot of optimism amongst Republicans that they can retake the Senate. In the House, Democrats are looking to me like they have a decent chance of flipping the House because of all the things that have gone on in the House, is that you've probably read in the papers and seen on television, trying to elect a speaker, getting rid of our speaker from California, Mr. McCarthy, and, you know, the contortions to get to another speaker and whether he'll survive what's ahead. But, you know, they don't feel like they're done either. So these just present challenges, and I think that most of things that will get done earlier in the year rather than later in the year. I think there won't be much appetite after the election to do a whole lot, depending on the outcome. In fact, they are trying to pre-negotiate some end of the year legislation now in the event that they find that they can't do anything at the end. So this is why Capital Conference is so important this year, is because it is kind of front-loaded. Our chances to get something done are much better for the first half of the year. And as you've seen with the border collapse of negotiation, presidential politics is already interfering with the ability to do meaningful progress on anything. And they still have to do appropriations. And as you know, March 1st is the first tranche at moving legislation for funding the government. And then again, March 8th for the second tranche.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. What does it look like right now in D.C. post-COVID, post-January 6, 2021, you know, storming the Capitol, all that sort of thing? I know it's the closest majority since the 1890s, and that must make it very difficult to get anything done, as you mentioned. Can you give us an overview of the political scene right now, and what can be set up for failure, and what is promising right now, if anything? Can you just kind of fill us in on all of this? I know you started to. I know it's a lot.
Yeah, sure. So, well, employer reporting has been an issue that we've worked on since the ACA. So it's been about a decade. And as you know, these rules for how employers have to report everyone who has health insurance has been a challenge. And that's because the IRS was asked to write the provision that developed the construct for reporting without any input from employers and without any appreciation on how employers differ. As we said earlier, you know, employers are not all the same and markets are not all the same, but no consideration was given for, you know, seasonal workers or retail or, you know, anything having to do with the composition of an employer. And in fact, you know, everything has to be done by paper, by mail. And who opened mail during COVID? Who even got, you know, picked up the mail and checked? And you have 30 days to comply, right? So the new legislation that we've modified in every session, I think we got it down pretty well. You now would have 90 days to, and it wouldn't have to be just by mail. There are guardrails against the IRS pursuing employers for, you know, those demand letters, the 226J letters, mm-hmm. that is outside of current law or regulatory constructs, because they are so far behind in auditing that, you know, it could be 20 years later and the door seemed to be wide open for them to pursue an employer and with one of these demand letters.
Yeah, and I was just going to mention that I just did a webinar with my attorney the other day, and her and I were talking in the webinar, and she was saying that right now they're focusing on, and they're sending out, the most recent are the 2021 226J letters, so they are catching up rapidly because it took them a long time to get that first couple of years out, right? And they're already up to 2021 now, so employers beware. If there's anything going on, you haven't filed those properly, watch out because they're catching up.
And, you know, when we did technical assistance with Treasury with regard to the legislation, you know, we did have a prospective reporting piece included here in which an employer could provide a list of those with, you know, that met the two-prong test for affordability. And then the exchanges would have that. So if an employee went to the exchange to seek a subsidy, they would know from the list that their healthcare home was back with their employer, but they claimed that they could not fulfill that part of the requirement in the law, and so it was dropped. But the other pieces, again, other pieces of relief, not having to report Social Security numbers and so forth, we think are still very good and does provide some relief. So there's a lot of energy, I think, to do so. I mentioned earlier that they're negotiating the end of the year package. The employer reporting legislation is in that part of that negotiation. If that fails to become part of that package, we still have the option to do something they call hotline, which basically allows the sponsors of the bill to find out if there's anyone who objects to the bill if it comes to the floor. And so they'll run a hotline in the Republican side and on the Democratic side. And so that's still at our disposal. But I really feel like this one, we're very close, yeah, and might finally get across the finish line.
Yeah. And just for the listeners that may not understand what he was talking about, altogether, NABIP and other organizations and other associations and so forth have been trying to get Washington to understand that the employer reporting is very difficult for employers, very time-consuming, very costly, software, payrolls, you know, information, reporting systems, that's all very, very expensive and very difficult. And they're trying to get them to make the reporting voluntary rather than mandatory. So I just wanted to follow up and mention that, John, just for those that may not be as familiar with that. So I do have to kind of get back to the politics a little bit because this is an election year. So I apologize for that. I do have to ask this because I have to. But does there seem to be any concern at all that Trump, while winning in the polls for the Republican nomination, everywhere we look, could end up, you know, with one or more convictions on more than one charge? I mean, does everybody there seem to wear rose-colored glasses in Washington? Has there been any congressional response at all to the sexual assault and defamation case that he lost recently? What's going on with that in Washington?
Well, okay, so I look at this in two different ways. There is the inside Washington perspective, and I think that it's very different than the perspective in outside of Washington, D.C. I think, you know, Pennsylvania and other states, they see this in the Midwest. They see this very differently than we do inside the Beltway. I think there is a fight going on for the soul of the Republican Party. Let's just be clear about that. And but he still has a lot of influence inside Washington.
Tremendous amount.
In the House and in the Senate, which is what you we started this conversation saying, that it's disrupting the ability to legislate. And presidential politics is really encroaching again. And the fact that, you know, we're probably going to have the same nominees that we did in 2020 in the last election. I don't think that people seem to think that former President Trump, these charges and so forth, they think it's a political gambit. And so I think until it actually goes to court and goes through that legal process, you know, it's hard to say. This is really kind of uncharted waters.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And a very difficult situation, I'm sure, for all of you guys in Washington inside the belt. So what happens if Republicans do nominate Trump and he's sent to prison before or after the election? Is there any chance of these charges being decided before the election, or I know he wants them to be after the election, of course. Everybody but Nikki Haley has left the race. What's going on with the Republican Party right now? Can you fill us in on that a little bit?
Well, as I said, I think there's sort of a fight for the soul of the Republican Party. Look, I think a lot of members, legislators feel that when he was president, they did a lot of positive things.
Yeah, they did.
They were largely pleased with, you know, the way the economy ran and the tax bill that they did and those sorts of things. Though every morning, you know, we woke up to what new tweet would drive the news for that day. Mm-hmm. And what how that would impact policy. But aside from that, I think that's where they kind of have a sense of nostalgia. But all the things that happened following January 6th, and that has changed a lot of Republicans who have a longing for the Republican Party as it was before Trump. And so that's kind of where the rub is between before Trump and after Trump. We might remember the Tea Party emergence after when President Obama came on the scene and how that affected the 2010 elections following the passage of the ACA. And, you know, it's still playing out. And even the election for Speaker, you saw a lot of those same dynamics taking place there, where the so-called rhinos or, you know, traditional party Republicans were on one side, and sort of the Trumpian Republicans, you know, far Freedom Caucus people on the other. But because the margins are so close, we don't really have a governing majority that can overcome that fine line between the two sides of the party. But that doesn't mean that, you know, Democrats are necessarily as unified either. They look at President Biden as a, you know, last night you saw the president defending himself on television with regard to the report about his age and so forth. And I think that that has been, you know, whispered around town for the past year. That his age was an impediment. And there are Democrats who think that that is an impediment. And then there are those who don't think so. So I think this is going to be a very stressful election and, you know, very divisive once again. And we'll just have to see how it plays out. But it's not unprecedented that we've had two people running against each other in a contentious race. If you look back in the 19th century, that happened a couple of times.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you mentioned Biden's age, which gets talked about a lot, of course. And, you know, there are other concerns, potential memory issues and so forth. Is anyone facing the fact that, you know, Kamala Harris could be the president at some point in the near future if Biden should win again? Because that could change everything in Washington. I mean, let's face it, Biden is a moderate Democrat. Kamala Harris is not. I live in California. She's from California, so we know her pretty well here. You know, President Biden, of course, won the South Carolina Democratic primary recently, of course. What would that do to the political environment in D.C. if, again, they elect a president like President Biden, something happens, and Vice President Kamala Harris steps up? That would change everything.
So few people want to talk about that because that's a tough conversation to have. Mm-hmm. But that is being discussed, and that's why you've seen the vice president getting out there on certain issues like abortion and you know, issues that she's more conversant in to sort of, quote, rehabilitate her image before the electorate. But no one's really talking about the succession issue that much, though, you know, when we get into the general campaign, I wouldn't be surprised if that came up. But
I'm sure it will. I'm sure there'll be plenty of TV commercials going back and forth.
Right.
On that topic alone. Yeah, for sure.
But, you know, let's just hope that however the outcome turns out, that it is accepted.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't need another repeat of what happened in early 2021, for sure. Are there future leaders in either party that could step up for, let's say, the midterms in 2026 and the presidential election in 2028?
Well, that's an interesting question. And I think that the answer is yes. I think this is part of where we find out where the parties land. I think both parties are going to have, you know, the Democrats don't have a deep bench either. And so they're going to, you're going to see new leaders emerge from their side as well as from my side on the Republican side. You know, the Republicans that I talk to believe in climate change, believe it or not. They have a different take on abortion than you might expect. And so, you know, we'll see kind of what side sort of prevails here, if you will. Mm-hmm. America is changing and it's always changed. So I think it's going to be someone who has a real presence about them and is willing to step up and say, this is the direction we need to go in. And so far, no one has really done that yet. Yeah. And I think as long as Trump is in the picture, that will be hard for someone to emerge.
Right. Right. Yeah. Because he still has, as you said, he has a lot of pull in Washington still, for sure. Well, let's talk about the key races in the House and the Senate, because obviously that's a big discussion for this election year. Are there certain districts that are ripe for a change in party? The houses are so close, as you mentioned earlier. Any little race could swing the majority, you know, and the state of Washington politics overall. What are your thoughts on this?
So look at the list of retirements. The list is rather long. But they're coming largely from pretty safe seats and on both sides. And that's the way districts are drawn these days. It's, you know, usually fairly safe Democrat or Republican. I think the action is going to be with New York and North Carolina. And North Carolina lines are being redrawn, likely to favor Republicans. And New York could actually go the other way. And so one of the issues they've been discussing recently, you may have seen in the news, is regard to what they call SALT. And that was a provision that was part of the 2017 tax legislation. The idea was to stop states like yours, Dorothy, in California and New York and New Jersey and Maryland, where I live, from placing higher property taxes on people because they felt like since you could write it off on your federal taxes, they saw that as a piggy bank to raise taxes. But this is really affecting New York Republicans a lot. And they feel like if this could be adjusted or provide some relief, it would help them in the coming election. And so they actually took a page out of the playbook of the Freedom Caucus and said, no, we won't vote for that unless you give us some relief. And so they had an agreement that they would vote on that issue separately. So watch New York carefully. The Democrats are looking to rejigger the lines there to favor the Democrats. And we know North Carolina is going to go the other way. Kathy McMorris Rogers from Washington just announced her retirement, which took us all by surprise. I mean, no one saw this coming at all. And, you know, I've known her since her first day in Washington. She has a child with disabilities, and she got a bill passed that dealt with discrimination against those with disabilities for receiving services. And I just have so much respect for her, and she will be sorely missed. She worked across the aisle with Mr. Pallone, and they continue to do good work in the Energy and Commerce Committee.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. You mentioned that I'm in California, and that it's always a different political environment here, of course. And as a lot of our listeners know, and I'm sure you're aware of, in California, the Democrats have for some time now held a supermajority here, not only in the two houses in the legislature, but also every major office across the state. So that makes it difficult for people that are conservative like myself. There's a reason why I live in Orange County, because that's traditionally been an pretty conservative county. And yet that's not even, you look at our legislators here in California, in Orange County, and it used to be all Republican, and it's not anymore. So you're right. California and New York are very interesting states. And again, that's why I have to keep asking people like you these questions. And, I want people to understand kind of what's going on out there. So thank you for that. So we've covered probably a lot more than either of us anticipated on the political front, but that's a good thing. Let's move on to some legislative and regulatory issues. Let's start with something near and dear to my heart. It's the 50th anniversary of ERISA, and that's very important to me because I work with a lot of self-funded health plans. A lot of clients of mine are self-funded, and it's also very important to employers, whether they're fully insured or self-funded. Can you tell us why ERISA is so important and why this anniversary is so important?
Well, sure. I'd be glad to, because it's one of the pillars on which our employer-based system is based on. It's the foundational building block for the great benefits that employees enjoy, right? The ability to provide the same benefits across multiple states where, prior to ERISA, that was all governed by the state. And it was impossible to put together a coherent plan in multiple states. And so ERISA provided that uniformity. Between that and the employer exclusion, those are the two lines in the sand that NABIP will never cross. We guard that with our life, so to speak, yeah. Right? This is because it's everything. Otherwise, then we just have single payer. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So without it, so the Education and Workforce just released a request for information about ERISA. And we're delighted. We're also worried about what those who want to great mischief might say about this. Mm-hmm. So we're in many coalitions, employer coalitions, And we're talking about this very vigorously on how we want to approach the RFI. And we'll be commenting on it. Here's how I see it. The healthcare landscape has changed a lot in 50 years. There are stakeholders who did not exist 50 years ago who are a part of the fabric of infrastructure around healthcare, being 1/6 of the economy. So we have PBMs, we have TPAs, and a whole range of other stakeholders. And I've noticed over the past several years, Congress inserting greater fiduciary responsibilities to employers with penalties for non-compliance. And as you know, as you try to report on mental health parity, it's impossible to get stakeholders to provide timely, accurate data for you to report. Mm-hmm. And the penalty falls on you, not on the stakeholders. And so I think something about that has to change. You don't own the data that you are being asked to supply.
Right.
And you rely on your partners or that you work with for that information, whether it's the carrier or whomever. And this is true whether it's now you have to report not just on mental health, but on prescription drugs data. It has to be machine readable and all that. And guess who gets flagged for these non-compliance issues? Not to mention, I worry about, you know, smaller group sizes, just like in reporting, it falls to the agent to assist them rather than a CPA. So anyway, that's sort of the direction I'm thinking about, where we will want to comment that responsibility for providing these oversight data points have to be shared with the stakeholder, and in particular with regard to the penalty. Because we're trying to keep employers in the game. And if we keep piling on more and more and more on them, they're just going to stop. And they're going to say, let's let the government do it. I mean, eventually it's going to break. So that's where I'm hoping we go with ERISA. But it's a big talking point for our fly-in in February 25th through 28th. You know, most members of Congress and their staffs don't understand what ERISA is and why it's important.
Right.
And so that's a story that you can tell very quickly with 600 of you here, that it would take my Democratic partner, Michael Handel, and I months to do. And so we really appreciate everyone who comes, because you really do are extending our reach. And you as a constituent, it's kind of a three-legged stool. You know, I'm the professional lobbyist and I know how to talk about it, but you're from where you're from, right? Where they come from. And so that's really important to them. And there's a great pride in that.
Well, thank you for that. You did mention one acronym that some of our listeners may not be familiar with. So if you wouldn't mind, could you define RFI?
Oh, sure. That's a request for information. So they're just looking for, they ask a number of questions, and then we respond to those questions that we want to answer.
Right. And those are done officially. They send out requests to the public. Please respond to this. And so, yeah, I've actually responded on those myself as well from time to time. Well, let's talk about increased fiduciary responsibilities, not only ERISA, like you just mentioned, but also with the CAA, which you mentioned briefly, whether or not people realize that or not. We'll get back to that in a second. And the Department of Labor issuing cybersecurity guidance and so forth. All these additional responsibilities, that's a lot of additional work for employers and a lot more responsibilities than they might be aware of, right? As you mentioned the CAA, and you mentioned something very briefly about RX reporting, the prescription drug reporting. That RxDC process was not easy. I know I had to do it myself. My business partner and I actually had to go in. It took us months to get approved in the HIOS portal to be able to do that for our clients, because we have a lot of self-funded clients. And that reporting process was not simple. I don't know how, particularly like self-funded employers, unless they paid a lot of money to their TPAs and so forth to do it for them, I honestly don't know how they would have done it themselves. And this additional responsibility is additional work that, like I said, in the DOL cybersecurity guidance, if anybody's read that guidance, I mean, that puts so much burden on employers to make sure that they understand that they're supposed to be having vendors in place that are cybersecurity compliant. I mean, you already talked about it, but what are your overall thoughts about all this additional responsibility in addition to the stuff you talked about with ERISA on employers?
So when I joined what was NAHU then, there was a great poster in the office of an agent walking, and he had on a bunch of hats, and they were like, he had a sombrero and then a Bromberg and, you know, all these different kind of hats piled up on top. And now I see it as a bunch of weights that are weighing them down. And this is where what I'm talking about with regard to the stress that employers feel, and how your role as an advisor has evolved tremendously. It's not just presenting plans anymore. The compliance hat you wear is the sombrero. It's the biggest hat on your head, and on what they rely on you most for. Because if you color outside the lines incorrectly, you know, there's a potential penalty ahead of you. So I think that we really need to look at agents differently than we did when I started 24 years ago. Mm-hmm. And Dorothy, you've been involved in compliance from the beginning, because I remember
right. Yeah, many, many years ago, right? Yeah, I've been still doing it. Yeah. I mean, I have no choice. Well, I ran a third-party administrator, so for many years, at my early 20s, I was thrown into, you know, the situation where, can you run this TPA? Who better to run a third-party administrator that processes claims than someone who'd never paid a claim before in their life? So I had to jump in right from the beginning, and guess what? As an administrator, we had to know, you know, all the compliance. We had to understand all of this. So I literally had to sink or swim, and I refused to drown. So I had to dive in, and I've been doing that my entire career, and it's just been crazy. You know, you've seen the number of articles I put out any given year. I probably have, you know, 6 to 10 articles published, and, you know, doing all this stuff. And it's all because this stuff is so complicated, and I don't expect employers to understand it at all. You know, it takes me, you know, so much time, so many hours to read all this stuff, figure it out, write something up about it, make sure I'm, you know, on the right track, and then run it by my attorney to make sure what I'm understanding is actually, correct and true. So I don't know what I'd do without my attorney, by the way. Thank you, Marilyn Monahan. Let's give her a shameless plug real quick. But just in the last couple of years alone, like I said, the cybersecurity guidance, the RxDC reporting, the gag clause filing, I had to do all that for all my clients too. So we've had to do all this stuff, and a lot of brokers and consultants do. And it's just crazy, crazy, crazy. So hopefully employers understand this stuff is not easy. And when your broker is actually saying they're going to help you with this, take them up on that and let them help you with that, because I don't know how you're going to do it on your own if you don't, right? I mean, agents play a very, very important role here.
I remember you cutting your teeth on HIPAA.
Oh, yeah.
And remember that?
That's still a big part. I have a HIPAA division in my company. We have a separate division that's all about HIPAA privacy and security. I know all about that. Yes. Thank you for remembering, by the way. Thank you.
Oh, yes, of course.
Yeah. So let's talk about, you mentioned this in the beginning, but I want to come back to it because, again, it's pretty important. Let's talk about the employer reporting responsibilities that come from the Affordable Care Act.
All right. Well, so we worked with the departments of Treasury and IRS for several years, and they created some flexibilities that they could within their ability and desire to do so. But then we hit a wall, and they said, you know, we can do no more because, well, it's laid out in statute. And to change this something in statute, you've got to change the law. And so we thought, well, okay, we'll do that. And the problem was that for Democrats, the ACA was perfect and didn't need any change. Mm-hmm. And for Republicans, well, we're just going to repeal it all. And so don't worry about that. And that was the sort of struggle that we were in. But as we went from one session of Congress to the next, two things happened. One is that members of Congress changed over. So we had new people. And while we had to educate them, they were more inclined to listen to us, you know, as time went by. And we made good improvements to the bill each time. So each iteration got better. And that's what I was saying at the beginning, is that I think we've got it down to as good as we can get it without having prospective reporting. And I know that there are people who sort of were opposed to prospective reporting, but the point was, is it was voluntary. It wasn't required. And so larger employers who have systems in place already and are comfortable with the way that they process could continue to do so. But I was thinking about the smaller employers when we did that, and the ease of reporting that and relieving them of some of that worry that someone would go to seek a subsidy for which they weren't eligible. And you know, the clawback's 100% in this case if you have an offer of coverage that meets the affordability test. I don't know anyone who's ever had a clawback. I'm not saying that maybe they haven't happened, but you just don't hear about it, do you? And so I just wonder how many of our tax dollars are going out the door that shouldn't be.
Right, right. Well, let's talk about another situation here. What exactly is site neutral and why is that important? That's a buzzword we're hearing right now.
For many years that I've spent at NABIP or NAHU, we've always talked about the cost of care, right? And that it's very expensive, or that healthcare just is expensive. So this is the first time that they're looking at doing something specifically that addresses the cost of care. And what site neutral is, everyone knows that hospitals are picking off outpatient. There's a lot of hospital, mergers and acquisitions going on, particularly of outpatient facilities. And so this has to do with the way that Medicare pays providers. So if you go to an outpatient clinic, they pay a certain fee for that service. But if you get your care in a hospital, they pay more because you have added expenses if it's in a hospital, right? There's more equipment and providers there, and they even tack on a facility fee for that service. So here's what happens. When they purchase an outpatient clinic that you've been taking your daughter for checkups for a long time and you just go in the office, and now it's part of the hospital system, your out-of-pocket is dramatically increased because now you're paying the hospital rate instead of the outpatient rate for the service. So you may have had a copay of $50 and now it's $100.
Or $400 or $1,000.
There you go. Mm-hmm. And so we've really conditioned people to look at their benefits to make sure that you're in network and so forth. And you think you're doing the right thing. And little do you know that someone once told me they went to the outpatient place they go to, and it was a sign on the door that said, you may experience an increase in your copay because of a facility fee that's being added to your bill. And it doesn't affect the improved care at all, right? This is right. Not a question of improvements here. It's just a legal way, which I think is, I don't want to use the word dishonest, but it's manipulative, right? Mm-hmm. It's a legal loophole that allows them to do it. And so the hospitals are crying foul. You're going to put rural hospitals out of business. Our specialty hospital can't survive. Well, what I would say to that, two things. One is that you got to find another way to provide better service, to increase your traffic or whatever it is. But doing it through a billing manipulation is just inherently un-American, in my opinion, right? We have a great sense of fairness in this country, and that just doesn't smell right when, we got to keep them afloat because you know, I see enough building cranes to know that they're doing just fine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But
and they get all the mergers, as you said before, all the mergers and acquisitions. And it's just kind of crazy right now. And it's really crazy, in my opinion, as well.
But there's a government entity called MedPAC. So it's a government sort of entity that when they did the analysis of site neutral, and they said that the savings is so great that you could redirect some of those savings back to specialty hospitals and rural hospitals for a period of time as they transition under the rules. So no one's going to close their doors. And it's the first thing that they always say, no matter what the issue is, if it has to do with any sort of cut to hospital payment, it's rural hospitals are going to close their doors. But look, hospital CEOs have the cell phone numbers of their senators on speed dial.
Mm-hmm.
And they are spending seven figures to fight this. And we're fighting for the consumer and for the people that you represent. And again, that's the story you're going to tell in Washington when you come for Capitol Conference to your legislator. I think that in an election year in particular, you think that the sensitivity to the consumer would be greater than to the hospital. They are obsessed in Washington about cutting out the middleman. What about sticking up for the little guy?
Yeah.
Who doesn't have $400 in their bank account, mm-hmm. if something goes wrong. And we're going to double or triple their out-of-pocket costs for seeking services that they rely on, that they need, simply over this billing loophole. Mm-hmm. It's just wrong.
Yeah.
And Mr. Schumer is one who seems to be determined to stick up for the hospitals in New York. And so we'll see if we can shake this loose. But look, one of the things I love about NABIP is that I love the issues that we work on. I feel like they're the issues of the white hat, as I call it, the good guys, right? We're representing consumers. And I know how passionate you all are in all lines of business for your clients, whether they're Medicare beneficiaries or your group clients or individuals. You're helping place them in coverage that's right for them, that best meets their financial and health needs.
Yeah, and I think one important thing to just bring up and mention, something that I know NABIP says all the time, and we do hear it all the time in California as well, is that the cost of health insurance is going up so much, right? The cost of health insurance is going up because the cost of health care is going up. And for some reason, consumers don't quite tie those together. Health insurance has to go up in cost when these providers keep increasing, as you mentioned, all these different levels of fees and facility charges and all these things. If those costs are going up, health insurance has to cover that, right? I mean, it has to go up at least some percentage of the total amount of increase on the provider side and the cost of care itself. And I think people forget about that, and they kind of always that bad insurer, it's always that bad insurance company's fault and all that kind of thing, because they're charging me more in premiums. It's not always the insurance company. You have to look at where the costs are coming from. The costs are coming from, health providers, the providers on this, because they have to be able to cover their costs too at the insurance company level, right? So it's
kind of crazy. What I would say to your customers that say that is that they have to be actuarially sound. So how would you feel if you submitted a claim for service and they didn't have the money to pay the claim? That's why you need to collect enough premiums to cover the claim.
Right.
And then you would be on the hook for that bill. So there has to be a balance.
Right. Exactly. Well, let's talk about something else, because I think it's pretty important. PBMs seem to be in the crosshairs of Congress. What's the latest on legislation to create more transparency on the pharmacy benefit manager side?
So the manufacturers of prescription drugs, of course, we love them. We need them because they invent new cures, right?
Mm-hmm.
But rather than looking at the cost of drugs, they've deflected the debate to PBMs. When I lobbied on the Medicare Modernization Act many years ago, PBMs were well thought of. as a partner of employers as a way to negotiate the cost of drugs. Now, that industry has changed a lot too over the years, but they've been really good at making them the target of Congress's ire now as the middleman. Mm-hmm. They're obsessed with middlemen. And so we followed the legislation in the House. They did a reasonable job between three committees of jurisdiction, which is kind of unheard of in this era, especially. We've been just talking about how dysfunctional it is and everything, but they actually came together and passed the lower costs, greater transparency bill, which NABIP supported all along the way. And it's sitting over in the Senate. So the Senate is still working through the committee process on their view on PBMs. But what I don't like about what they're doing over there is that they're taking away choices specifically around spread pricing that smaller employers rely on. And the reason they rely on spread pricing is because it's known, right, what you're going to pay from month to month. And for them, that is very important to them. The other method that the larger employers prefer is also okay. But let me illustrate it, okay? So I know a broker who had a group of about 300 lives, and spread pricing saved them $500,000, so $500,000. And that was their choice. The other option, they came back with a proposal to add like $300,000 to the rebate. Now, if I'm that customer, I would be saying, gee, you could have saved me $300 on my rebate, but you never offered that before. And that's my point. It's about competition in the market. And don't take away a choice until you can replace it with another option that works. So to reduce everyone down to only one option for negotiation, it's not a negotiation.
Right.
And so I kind of feel like it has its place. And as long as we institute greater transparency on how all of this is done, I think that's the important first step here. But eliminating it completely is allowing the government putting its finger on the scale in favor of one solution or another, and removing market options is not what we've ever been about. Mm-hmm. And so it's unsettled. That who knows if they come to some sort of agreement on PBMs, despite the desire to do something on it. There is a thing called the calendar, the legislative calendar. And if you look at it, you know, they always take August off for recess in Washington. That's a tradition here. And they, in fact, will be out in August. And they will also be out virtually all of October to campaign. So that doesn't leave a lot of legislative days to do a lot.
Right.
And at the pace that they're moving, I don't know that we'll get agreement on PBMs by then. But we'll see.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I know you spent a lot of time just now talking about PBMs, but I do want to come back to it for just a minute. What is happening in the states on PBMs and, you know, pharmaceutical industry in general?
So there's a lot of activity at the state. And part of it is because there's a sense in the states that the federal government isn't doing enough in these areas. So they want to legislate and take over. And, you know, we've always had a sort of states' rights attitude about things up to a point where it doesn't cross ERISA, but they're actually proposing legislation in states that circumvents and breaches ERISA. So again, I'm glad it's the 50th anniversary of ERISA because it gives us an opportunity to talk about the role of ERISA and that, you know, it's about 25% of an employer's spend. Mm-hmm. Pharmaceuticals
easily.
And so if we allow states to do what create provisions that allow, for example, them to control plan design, that would be bad, right? And dispensing fees in Tennessee, they raised dispensing fees dramatically And there is a number attached to it, and it's slipping my mind, but it's massive. You know, they have TennCare there, and all your public programs are now paying millions of dollars more in dispensing fees for no, again, just like site neutral, for no added health benefit at all. It's simply to line the pockets of the local pharmacist. Look, I like local pharmacists. I don't have anything against them. But adding these dispensing fees, again, has a premium impact and raises costs for people. And what are we getting for that buck? And so that's Illinois has a dispensing fee bill right now. So we are really ramping up our state affairs efforts at NABIB. Max Carlin is doing a great job in working with our states. We have a strong software that kind of looks for keywords on state legislation, and we're in touch with the states on these different bills. And I'm really excited about our state affairs shop. I know that California is one of the best at following state issues because you have so many going on in California year after year.
We do. Lucky us.
Right? For better or for worse. So PBM and pharmacy issues in general are a big deal right now.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, let's talk about the congressional health care package. March 8th is a pretty important date. Can you tell our listeners about what this is and why it's so important?
Well, that will be the health care package. And we're hoping that, as you know, there were some telehealth flexibilities that came about during the pandemic, particularly for those with HSAs, and that they could avail themselves of telehealth services without concern for the deductible. And so we got it extended through 2024, and we're hoping that this is very bipartisan, bicameral, meaning both House and Senate are in agreement on this. And we're hoping that that is one of the things that is in the package on March 8th. I don't think our employer reporting bill will be in there, which is why they're trying to negotiate it for the end of the year. But this is the one opportunity, I think, to really get some good things done. Do I wish there were other things like COBRA's credible coverage in there, or the observation status issue in Medicare were in there? I could spend a lot of time talking about that too. There's so much that I really care about, but this is the opportunity to get some constructive things done. And I think the telehealth would be nice if it were in there.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, I'm afraid we're out of time today. Thank you so much, John, for being with me here today and sharing your thoughts on all of this stuff. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure to be with you today. If you want to contact me, you know, I'm on our website at nabib.org, or you can email me at jgreen@nabib.org. And I have an E on the end of my last name, so don't forget to add the E.
Yes, I was going to remind you of that, to tell people that for sure. Well, thanks again. I really appreciate you, John. To everybody else out there listening, please stay safe, stay healthy, and stay tuned for the next episode of the Benefits Executive Roundtable. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for compliance tips, cost containment ideas, new trends, and decision-making tools. This podcast is produced by Advanced Benefit Consulting, Anaheim, California. All views expressed are those of the host or interviewees and not necessarily those of Advanced Benefit Consulting. Information contained herein should not be construed as legal advice. We always recommend that you consult with your legal counsel, as situations do vary. Ms. Koshu can be reached at 714-693-9754, extension 3. Toll free at 866-658-3835. Or visit our website at advancedbenefitconsulting.com.